Welcome back to Gray Matters, the podcast of the Seaboard and Gray Center for the Study of the Administrative State. I'm Jace Lington, the Center's Research Director. Today's episode is a panel discussion from a recent event we co-sponsored with the Manhattan Institute and the Federalist Society.
If I could have your attention, we'll get going, because I know everyone's going to have things they've got to get to this afternoon. We appreciate everyone coming today. I'm James R. Copeland. I am a senior fellow with and director of legal policy for the Manhattan Institute for Policy Research in New York. On behalf of MI and our fellow sponsors of this event, the Federalist Society and the C. Boyd and Gray Center for the Study of the Administrative State at Antonin Scalia School of Law at George Mason University, we welcome all of you here today to this program. So thanks to the C. Boyd and Gray folks and FedSoc for making this easy for me. We're based in New York, so I have to show up, but all the coordination was done by other folks. I really appreciate it. And we have today, the topic is called A Debate on the Right, and we will get into that debate in a moment. But climate lawsuits and federalism, what is the role of state tort law? And to discuss this, we've got some really outstanding folks, all of whom I've known for some time and are just really leaders in their various fields intersecting here. To my immediate left is Jonathan Adler, the Johann Verhey Memorial Professor of Law at the Case Western Reserve University School of Law, where he's also the director of the Coleman P. Burke Center for Environmental Law. And then next to Jonathan, we have Donald Kochan, the professor of law at the Antonin Scalia Law School at George Mason, and the executive director of the Law and Economics Center there. And then finally, we have Jennifer Mascott, who's an assistant professor of law at George Mason and the co-executive director of the C. Boyd and Gray Center, our co-sponsors for this event. So welcome to all of you, and thanks to our co-sponsors. You know, I do want to say at the outset, and I don't know if I need to do this or not, but I mean, what we have here, the case that sort of prompted this forum, which is the Supreme Court is considering whether to grant certiorari in this case, Sunoco v. Honolulu, you know, involves a multiple oil interests and companies, as well as multiple municipalities. Want to disclose just that I do own security shares in several of those oil companies, and I'm sure some of them give money to my employer, the Manhattan Institute. Unfortunately, we have a separate development department. I'm not aware of exactly how or where that money is or goes, but, you know, take that into consideration. I don't think it's going to be influencing the way I think about the legal questions here, and I assume the same would be true for our panelists, all of whom have distinguished records of scholarship and thinking in these issues. So, you know, this case before us is one that ultimately, at this juncture, it revolves around questions of federal preemption of state tort law, particularly but not exclusively public nuisance law of tort. Those of you who followed the sort of climate change arena and the law, you know, are doubtless aware that we've had state plaintiffs before in front of the court. You know, in 2007, Massachusetts v. EPA, states had a special solicitude of standing to challenge the interpretation of the Clean Air Act and regulation of greenhouse gases. And then 4 years later, American Electric Power, AEP v. Connecticut in 2011, we had similar legal claims to this one that were rejected by the Supreme Court under the theory, in an opinion written by Ruth Bader Ginsburg, under the theory that the Clean Air Act displaced the federal common law of nuisance in this area, but that opinion expressly reserved questions of state law which weren't in front of the court. And so that's where what we have here. This case has already shown itself in front of the court already in terms of should this be removed to federal court, and it came up once and went back down to the Ninth Circuit. The court denied cert the second time, which is how we wound up in Hawaii court here. Brett Kavanaugh dissented from that denial of certiorari. And so now we're back in Hawaii state court, and the question here is, to what extent are these state tort law claims and other state law claims preempted federally? And why do we call this a debate on the right? I think You have various factions of the right and how they think about the law. And so, on one side, you have I think everyone agrees with a robust structural constitution. As Justice Kavanaugh said, you know, that is a guarantor of individual liberties. And I think there's a fair amount of consensus on the right when it comes to the structural constitution that's horizontal. In other words, you see the court taking steps. We've got it in Loper Bright this term. We had it in West Virginia v. EPA with major questions. We have this sort of series of cases where the court is trying to step in and reconfigure some of the law in terms of the allocation of powers between Article 1 and Article 2 branches, and where does Article 3 fit into that. So these sort of separation of powers questions, the horizontal questions, I think the right is broadly aligned. Where I think there's, at least intellectually, some differences among the right is in this vertical question, the federalism questions. I mean, everyone on the right likes federalism, but how they think about it differs. So intellectually, you know, my Michael Grieva, longtime at AEI, and now George Mason, you know, has been sort of the proponent of a fairly strong form for judicial engagement here in terms of enforcing the proper boundaries and parameters of law when it comes to federal versus state allocation. And then you've got sort of the more minimalist version that Justice Thomas, I think, sort of epitomizes here, you know, someone who basically rejects the Dormant Commerce Clause in Wyeth v. Levine, 2009, rejected implied conflict preemption entirely, basically saying that the states are reserved powers, period, and unless Congress speaks very clearly here, you know, it's not our job as judges to step in there and try to fix the national commercial space. We leave that to the Article I branch, not to ourselves. So I guess to start with that, I'll go to you, Professor Adler. Professor Adler has, of course, written a lot about preemption as well as environmental law. He's one of these sort of center-right, conservative libertarian people who takes environment very seriously and has a long history of writing in the space. And, you know, you think that, you know, whether you agree with the strong form I just sketched out for Justice Thomas or not, you think that here in this case there is no preemption, right? That Hawaii, whether the tort claim here on climate change, and it's a similar theoretical claim to what we saw in AEP versus Connecticut, but that the tort law here, whether Hawaii law gets it right or wrong, there's no preemption. Why is that?
Well, the short answer is because preemption is typically a consequence of legislative enactment, right? Congress, under the Supremacy Clause, has the power to preempt state law, to do so narrowly or broadly, but that requires Congress actually doing that. And in the context of climate change, Congress has not done that. Indeed, Congress has never expressly and knowingly enacted a statute regulating greenhouse gas emissions. It's most recently enacted statutes using fiscal tools to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and it's enacted pollution control statutes that courts have, after the fact, concluded can apply to greenhouse gases, but Congress has never taken any step to preempt there. And on top of that, there is a long history of states using a wide range of tools to deal with environmental problems within their borders, including those that extend beyond their borders or that even emanate from outside of their borders. And while historically those cases were heard under federal common law, post the displacement of federal common law for nuisance, the Supreme Court has held, again, I think correctly, that given the broad savings clauses that exist in our pollution control statutes, states can pursue those claims under state law. And the only limitations are things like due process limitations that could limit some types of extraterritorialization of state law. So, for example, under a case called International Paper versus Ouellette, in a transboundary pollution case, you can't impose the downwind states or downstream states law to an upwind or upstream producer, but you can sue them in state court as long as you apply the law of the source state. So there may be other structural limitations on the scope of Hawaii's claims or of Honolulu's claims, on the breadth of activities that can be subject to liability, the scope of relief that Honolulu could seek. Those are all the sorts of issues that would come up in trial. What the claim is in before the Supreme Court now, or what the cert petition is essentially asking the court to do, is not to leave those questions to be worked out in the context of litigation. You know, so is Honolulu limited to imposing liability on Sunoco for actions that Sunoco took in or directed at the Hawaii market, as opposed to those taken elsewhere? Rather, Sunoco wants the case essentially stopped now at the front end on a claim of preemption that, again, has no basis in any federal environmental statute, no basis in the court's preemption jurisprudence. And that I think, you know, involves what's essentially a kind of preemption by penumbra sort of argument that, as you suggested in the opening, is the sort of argument that traditionally conservatives have been anathema to, in the sense that that's not the job of courts. That however much there may be agreement that piecemeal state litigation is not a particularly efficient or effective or equitable way to deal with climate change, it's the job of the legislature to do something about that. It's not the job of courts to deploy various policy arguments to prevent plaintiffs from trying their shot in state court under state law.
I turn to Professor Cook. Now,
there's a lot you disagree with.
There's plenty I disagree with, but I'm supposed to be moderating here. So, although I think he frames the question properly. So Don, what's the other side of this story?
Well, I think as Jonathan pointed out, there is and as you pointed out in your introduction, there is an understanding among a number of folks on the right that there is a structural federalism that needs protection in cases like this, in which you have a recognition of why did we leave the Articles of Confederation and construct a constitution in which there is a federal government with divided authority. And of course, there is some residual authority available in the states, a vast majority of the authority is residual in the states through the 10th Amendment, but there are certain areas of high national concern in which issues of uniformity, issues of consistency across states, issues of coordination, issues of non-conflict between state laws that really need to be managed at the federal level and indeed should be managed at the federal level. I do think that we'll probably have more of a conversation as to whether or not that's actually been done. So one question then is you could agree that this should be managed at the federal level, but I think, and I don't know if Jonathan would agree with that, I think the reply is that it hasn't yet been done that way, right? One thing, if it hasn't yet been done that way, I do think that the court should take this case in order to make that pronouncement, because it will send a signal to Congress that there is a need for a clearer statement on whether or not they do wish to preempt in the first place. So I think that no matter where you stand on this issue, the court can serve a very valuable role at describing whether there is or is not preemption, and then create the space in which Congress and others can react to understand what goes forward after that. And certainly there can be a more consequential debate as to the interference the states can all have in a national agenda for climate change resolution, as well as a geopolitical global agenda that could be interfered with by a number of different states. But back for just a moment. On this idea of the meaning of federalism in a coordinated approach. If indeed we believe that there should be a role for the federal government, and the Clean Air Act in fact did this, then we can look at that backdrop to understand AEP versus Connecticut as not only displacing federal law, in other words, it was quite clearly stated that federal common law would not be able to continue in a way that was that had been occupied by the Clean Air Act. But that did not mean, as the Hawaii Supreme Court then took the approach that meant that, okay, if federal common law is now displaced by the Clean Air Act, that there is an open space, an invitation for state common law to fill the void that a federal common law might have held. I think that that's a poor interpretation of the case, but instead, the space that was left open AEP was that the states would have some residual authority to regulate purely intrastate activities. But when we're talking about global climate change, I'm not sure how you get to the limiting function that Jonathan is describing that he thinks could come out later in the litigation, in which you could ever say that you could isolate these claims as focused only on the acts in Hawaii. And so as a consequence, anytime you are talking about this coordination of forces that all lead to climate change, you can't sort of just pick out what impacts occurred because of the production or distribution of information or consumer information in Virginia versus in Hawaii as to what the effects are in Hawaii. I think this is where the Delaware Superior Court gets it right in the recent decision and saying, like, look, you can try to go for the interstate activities, but that's not likely to be very successful at an actual proof stage. So why should we waste the time to get to that point when we know that it's going to be impossible and the court could intervene at this point in time? The other thing about preemption I think we should take into account, there are rules for the states identified in the Clean Air Act, and I think that we should understand that the expression, including in the helping in the regulation of interstate pollution, and we should consider the delineated portions of the Clean Air Act which give the state roles as being limited to those state roles and not... And in many ways, then, foreclosing the opportunity for the states to be even more creative and innovative in the common law judicial space to create additional regulations that are only going to interfere with the ability to have a uniform and national policy.
Professor Mascot, do you have any thoughts here on this question?
Thank you. So as you mentioned, the case is largely right now being framed as a federalism question. And I think that fundamentally, as our previous speakers have indicated, essentially comes down to a fight or debate or conflict between two powerful governments. Which one wins, the federal government or the state government? And I guess I would just urge jurists and scholars and litigators and folks thinking through the questions here, which I imagine will only over time enter more areas as states get emboldened to have these lawsuits and hear these lawsuits and expansively interpret state tort law, is whether the states actually are exceeding the bounds of the traditional understanding of state common tort law to begin with. And so does anybody, rather than the federal government having had to act here to preempt, are the state courts actually exceeding the bounds of what we thought states had the power to do in the lawsuits they had the power to hear and the judgments they had the power to award at the time they entered the union as an original matter and then as time has gone on? And so I think that frames the question about whether they are exceeding the power here of their own court system and takes a little bit of the pressure off some of the concerns that Jonathan is raising. Because I think he's exactly right. This is a court that consistently, a lot of the conservatives, the folks who you would expect to be more concerned about economic interests and just freedom and liberty in general, sometimes also do not have a very broad view of federal preemption, Justice Thomas in particular. And so I don't think it seems to me unlikely here that there, and I don't think the court should go down the route of broadly or kind of changing preemption principles just because of the nature of the claims in play, but also in a constitutional structure. And this is, I think, similar to some of the points Donald was raising, although I don't think it's necessarily, he didn't use this term, but I don't think it's necessarily a due process, certainly not a dormant commerce clause principle, but under a constitutional structure where under Article 1, Section 10, you know, states can't enter compacts, they can't engage in international space, they can't impair contractual obligations. The idea that one state court here would be able to, and we're not just talking about tort claims that are about harms in the border, but are really going to potentially impact how companies are operating, how climate change is happening or isn't happening broadly, nationally, and internationally. Does an individual state court within our system have the power to issue the kind of remedy or judgment that's going to be in play here? And doesn't this raise some of the very kinds of conflict issues that were the entire reason, as Donald said earlier, for the formation of the union in the first place and that motivate Article 1, Section 10? I think a very striking feature of this litigation on the Supreme Court, this petition, is that already there's an amicus brief joined by many other states who are opposing Hawaii's petition here. And so normally, you know, you would think pro-state power, all states want states to be able to, state courts to be able to hear such claims, have this kind of authority. But right off the bat, there's a conflict between the policy that other states want and what might happen as a result of the case here. So I think I do imagine that the stakes are so great here that it would be very likely for the Supreme Court to take this case. If they don't, perhaps it's simply because there's concern about how the ruling would come down. But for what it's worth, the Gray Center actually had a panel on this topic a couple weeks ago, and my recollection, Jonathan, correct me if I'm wrong, because he was there as well, but I think everybody kind of put it the over-under at 90 to 95% that the Supreme Court would hear the case. Were you a dissenting voice?
Given how few cases they're taking, I don't think you'd bet that they can take it. Bet it's likely to take any case. That said, it's, as far as cert petitions go, a fairly strong one.
It's obviously a really big case, and I'm glad you went there talking about some of the Article 1, Section 10 powers, Jen, because it's, this is something I've been trying to hammer home over the last several years. In an article at Manhattan City Journal I wrote entitled The Four Horsemen of the Regulatory State and then expanded into a book, I wanted to make the case that as we continue to think about the administrative state, I think properly, in terms of rulemaking and enforcement, there is this sort of other layer of regulation that is incredibly important, and my Manhattan Institute colleague has been writing about it for almost 40 years now, which is our litigation system, particularly the tort litigation system, as it's grown. And tort law was not a big area of law at the beginning of the Republic, as recently as 1871. Oliver Wendell Holmes criticized someone who'd written a tort treatise saying, this isn't an appropriate study for a law book, right? But this obviously blew up a lot in the late 19th century. And then the interplay of that with the sort of state and local actors that Jen was just talking about, which I sort of call the new anti-federalism, which does seem to be very core to our constitutional structure overall. In the sense that, we don't vote for the people who get on the Hawaii Supreme Court or the City Council of Honolulu. If you're in North Carolina or Michigan or Wyoming or wherever, you may have a very different view. And for a state or local actor, which is a subspecies of the state, to be driving these national and global questions is a real concern. So I outlined that in a chapter of my book and talked about this is a very new sort of claim in the sense that where you have state and municipal actors trying to drive these hot button policy issues nationally comes after the Clean Air Act and the major amendments to the Clean Air Act. Really began with the state tobacco litigation in the late 1990s, and then we saw some public nuisance related claims on guns and Congress did act there and can act. I think it's a fair point, but with guns, we saw it with lead paint. Most of these are really silly tort claims, I think, for those of us who think about tort law conceptually, but they're these sort of policy advocacy arenas that state and local actors have been going in, and it creates necessary conflict among the sort of states. So how do you react to that, Jonathan? I mean, in terms of the, isn't this? Yes, the court has permitted a lot of this stuff to be going on, but if not now, then when? If you're talking about a global climate-related policy adventurism from the city of Honolulu, if that doesn't offend your structural constitutional principles, what does?
Well, so I think answering that, it's useful to initially take a step back. So if we think about the use of tort law, and in particular nuisance law, in the context of environmental protection, it goes back to the 17th century. You go back and find it at Bracton. You find it in cases like William Aldred's case, the principle that you can't use your property in a way that harms your neighbor. The debates we see today over the economic value of productive economic activity that may harm a neighboring property, those are the facts in William Aldred's case in 1611, right? A pig farm creating odors that prevent somebody from being able to enjoy their house next door. And At the state level and at the local level, nuisance litigation was the primary regulatory tool for dealing with environmental issues through most of our nation's history. If one goes and looks at the beginnings of environmental statutes, for example, to deal with air pollution in the late 19th century as part of the progressive smoke control movement, those arose in conjunction with the use of nuisance litigation to affect the location of industrial facilities. So part of the reason a lot of coal facilities were pushed outside of urban areas was by a combination of statutes, which were understood as exercising the state police power to control nuisances, and the use of nuisance litigation. And one reason for the shift towards regulation was from a matter of proof, being able to control activities, you know, kind of ex ante instead of ex post, it was seen as more efficient or more effective. But that was an instrument choice question at the state and local level. And so that's the background. Similarly, throughout most of our nation's history, there were all kinds of interstate nuisance cases, most of which were heard in the court's original jurisdiction. Former student of mine has this like 100-page law review article for those that are interested on the whole history of the use of original jurisdiction to deal with transboundary pollution problems. Those were heard under federal common law. The reason that went away and was displaced was not because of some grand structural discovery. In fact, it went away because post-Erie, the court had convinced itself that federal courts were not courts that could discover and apply general legal principles, could not act like common law courts. And so the displacement of federal common law is a product of the Erie notion that federal courts should not be in that business. And explicitly, that's where displacement comes from and why it's a different standard than preemption. And the idea is simply, if there's any federal action at all in that sphere, we displace federal common law, and then whether or not state common law exists for these claims is a question of what the statute says. That's what AEP says explicitly. It's what Milwaukee 2, which announces for the Clean Water Act, says explicitly. It's also what the International Paper versus Ouellette case says explicitly, the case that allowed Ouellette to sue International Paper for transboundary pollution. Now, so that, for traditional pollution, that is the history. What I think you were talking about is the rise of this sort of litigation as a policy tool, and certainly the explosion we see in the product liability context, where we see more, shall we say, innovative theories of causation. For purposes of our discussion, I'm agnostic about whether or not Honolulu could actually demonstrate by a preponderance of evidence that particular effects that are visited upon Honolulu and on its infrastructure can be traced to anthropogenic climate change and can be apportioned to some portion of those emissions that are properly within the jurisdiction of Honolulu of Hawaii courts. And I think that is, as in any case, that's part of the plaintiff's burden. And can they meet that burden? I don't know. Do they have a better chance of meeting that burden now than they might have 20 years ago? Yeah. Is attribution science progressed enough that they could actually do that? Don't know. Are some of their other claims, like the duty to warn claim, a bit innovative? Sure. But again, I think those are separate claims. In no other, you know, we in no other area of tort law do we now, as a regular practice, accept the idea that you can run to federal court and say, I don't like the fact that someone has an innovative tort theory under state law, make it go away before we have proceedings. We don't, you know, we didn't do that in the MTBE litigation, we don't do that in pharmaceutical litigation, where there is far more aggressive federal regulation than there is in the context of climate. And I don't see why we would do that here, particularly given the long history of fairly traditional tort tools to deal with pollution, including transboundary pollution. Maybe we should be doing that across the board. I'm open, that's an argument that I know Richard Epstein makes. I'm open to that. Maybe tort law shouldn't be used the way we're using it. But I think those are separate questions from whether or not we should be inventing a previously undiscovered form of preemption to apply to the sorts of cases that have been getting litigated under state law for centuries.
But I guess that so raises for me a question definitionally of, is what's happening here, like, precisely how would you articulate the claim and the relief being sought? Because my recollection at the start of your comments is that you said this has its origins in 17th century or earlier nuisance law. And so we're talking about neighbor, which made me want to say, who is my neighbor Is it the building next door? Is it India? Is it anything happening in Africa? And also, is it state law? I mean, so you said then, is it traditional nuisance, transboundary? Any claim, any relief? And so I guess for the environmental law experts here, what's precisely, and I think the court will have to look at this, precisely what is the claim that would have to be established in the relief sought that's causing the petitioners here to say this is a case of extraordinary importance that is going to impact international policy and conflict with many state laws? That sounds a lot bigger and more vast and different in kind as a constitutional matter, even, than the claims you were describing.
I mean, they want money, right?
Okay.
And they're going to have to show damages, and they're going to have to show damages that are within the cognizance and jurisdiction of the state court, and that's something they will have to prove.
But do they want money? I'm you know, yes, as a legal matter, they're seeking damages. But I mean, the gun companies don't have any money. No, none of these mayors were going after gun companies because they wanted the money that Colt had. No, they wanted to stop gun sales in America. That's what they were doing. I mean, yes, there's a long history of nuisance law. Yeah, if you don't want a brothel next door, if you don't want a stinky plant next door, you bring nuisance claims. Sure, sure. But isn't that quite different than the sort of claims we have here? The direct causation there, the proximity is not attenuated the way it is here.
Well, that's a question of proof. I mean, that's a question of proof, right? I mean, so what's different I think to answer Jen's question, what they're really afraid of is the fact that it's not one case, right? That there's, I forget how many, 15 of them or whatever. And if they all proceed, those are a lot of cases to settle. And that's a lot of checks to write. And that places a lot of pressure to make some sort of political deal to make those cases go away. Litigation is used strategically to impose costs on people you want to impose costs on. All the time, courts are, as I teach in my property case, I taught property this semester, my syllabus is filled with cases where one neighbor's being a jerk to their other neighbor and sue because they're upset about something else and it's a way to impose costs. And we know that. And so that's not a basis for federal intervention. The fact that there could be lots of these cases, not a basis for courts to intervene. It might be a basis for Congress to intervene. I don't think any of us disputes that Congress could make all these cases go away tomorrow if it wants. The question is whether or not it's a basis for finding preemption when Congress quite expressly did not preempt any state regulation or litigation in the context of air and water pollution, barring a few very narrowly targeted contexts like products that are sold in interstate markets, right? So there's preemption of automobile standards, there's preemption of truck standards, but there's, under the federal environmental statutes, preemption is rare, and it's very express, and it's very targeted, and maybe that's a mistake, but that's what Congress has done.
Couple quick things. I don't think Erie explains all of this, because if you think about it, there are certain areas which are just inherently federal, and that is things like national security, energy policy, other things which are reserved in the space that should be federal. And I think interstate global pollution fall into that category. And so I'm not sure that Erie can explain all of this. But on the second point, though, on this, are these cases different, and are they different in scale and kind? I think it is in. You were explaining sort of the strategy that's developed over time. There's a brief in this case, the National Association of Manufacturers brief, which tells the story of the La Jolla conference in 2012, in which there it was a post-AEP conference in which the plaintiffs bar and the environmental activists got together and said, how do we circumvent these barriers to using the courts in the way that we want to drive policy? And so, it's been a very effective campaign across all of that time to do so. And it's not just how do we overcome the absence of federal common law. It's also been how do we overcome the strictures of products liability by creating innovative theories that essentially defeat the compromises that are put into products liability law by finding new public nuisance torts or finding consumer deception claims and others that can say, look, we don't have to deal with the causation requirements that are in products liability. We don't have to deal with these well-compromised standards standards that have been developed in across conversations to create a coherent system of how to have a system of products liability in this country. So it has been an orchestrated campaign to overcome legal obstacles by finding innovative theories to skirt around or circumvent things over time. And so I think that when we're talking about that, it also then lends itself to these scale-based suits, which are really about setting policy for entire industries rather than a policy for someone getting relief from their neighbor causing them direct harm. And I think that does just change the nature of the lawsuits and therefore change the nature of the discussion and whether or not there's a broader role for federal preemption.
So if there's an organized legal strategy to use litigation to change the law, courts should treat the cases differently? Are we going to apply that principle across the board? Because I see a lot of cases that I think, some, including some that I think the three of us would be very sympathetic to, that quite clearly are part of an orchestrated campaign to get cases before the courts to change the law in a way to drive policy. And I think a lot of the administrative law litigation we see now could be described by its opponents in that way. I don't think that makes the cases somehow either A, less legitimate, or B, means that the courts should treat them any differently.
Well, it does show that they're not grounded in the history that you are claiming that they're grounded in, because they're grounded instead in a strategy to avoid the historical moorings that were keeping these cases controllable.
Or it's an effort to rediscover that history, right? I mean, I think a lot of originalist challenges to the administrative state are an effort to rediscover a history that's been lost. I would argue that the turn away from administrative regulation towards litigation in a lot of environmental contexts is in some respects an effort to rediscover and redeploy an old history that actually has firmer roots than the use of centralized administrative regulation and is checked by the courts performing their ordinary role by forcing plaintiffs to actually make their case within prescribed forms, bounded by notions of due process, which is, again, a separate question from whether or not you preempt those cases at the outset. I'm not saying these cases will or should win, right? My claim is that the effort to preempt them is an effort to kind of preclude the use of litigation in a way that it's traditionally been used. And the fact that some people sat in a boardroom and came up with these strategies, I mean, like, that happens with litigation all the time.
Yeah, but the kind of things you're talking about with national strategy and administrative regulation, the starting point is the reverse of what we're talking about here, where you have federal actors, federal entities, and people are challenging it. And not only that, so here we're talking about, should there be an absence of a governmental entity in our system thinking it can just create or manufacture these essentially new in scope causes of action, number one. Number two, I think the court has shown some discomfort with the change the regulatory state by litigation instead of statutes, which is why we see folks like Justice Thomas sometimes and Justice Gorsuch writing separate opinions, limiting remedies and creating a lot of havoc and consternation there for litigators. So the court's been resistant in that context, and I would be shocked if in a circumstance like this, dealing with the vast kind of hubris here of the state courts, that the Supreme Court is just going to give that a bye.
On rediscovering, I don't think that there is anything to rediscover in which states were exercising the power and ability to control the activities of and regulatory structures of other states, essentially, and interfering with those other states. There's not a history of states being so bold as to try to dictate national policy by taking things on themselves, which necessarily are going to constrict the activities of other states, including prohibit those other states from having an effective intrastate climate policy or intrastate pollution control policy, because the intrastate regulations will be interfered with by decisions by courts in other states.
I think that's untrue. I mean, the reality is that there's a long history of nuisance suits. When you file a suit against an upwind or upstream polluter, that necessarily is going to have effects on others than the plaintiff in that case. Right? When ULETT is suing International Paper, ULETT is not the only beneficiary of International Paper having to change its operations in another state to stop causing the downstream pollution. The fact that those what we might characterize as positive externalities are generated by that use of a fairly traditional legal form doesn't change the underlying analysis. And that's a case that post-Milwaukee 2, post-displacement, the Supreme Court said could go forward. And what happened in that case was after the Supreme Court said that, they settled the case because International Paper realized that even with the benefit of only being held to the law of the state in which its facility was operating, it was going to be liable to the downstream plaintiffs who were suing it. And so the fact that it had those sorts of effects in another jurisdiction doesn't preclude the use of the traditional tool. So again, my claim here is simply Honolulu will have to show that anthropogenic climate change is causing effects in Honolulu that impose costs on Honolulu, on its infrastructure, on sea level, whatever else. They will have to be able to show that by a preponderance of the evidence, and they will have to show what quantum of those effects can be attributed to defendants that are legitimately within the jurisdiction of state courts. And that may preclude relief. But the effort to preempt the case is to say they don't even get to make that showing, which is just the same thing that Ouellette was able to show when suing International Paper, that the Supreme Court has blessed, even in a post-displacement world, because it is the prior way that things were handled. The last thing I'll just say about this, we should remember about displacement, in the context of Milwaukee 2, if you go look at the papers of the justices, it certainly looks like the reason they even agreed to displacement wasn't because they thought post-Erie there shouldn't be federal common law for interstate harms. It's because the justices didn't want these cases in original jurisdiction in their lap. And they figured, well, Congress will take care of it. These cases will go away. That's hardly a principled basis for depriving downwind and downstream jurisdictions of the opportunity to make their case in court as they have been allowed to do since the nation's founding. And I think that's the claim here, that just because we're skeptical that this particular suit should ultimately win, again, it's a skepticism I share, shouldn't cause us to distort other aspects of legal doctrine in pursuit of that goal. And I think that's what we're doing, or what the plaintiffs are doing, or the petitioners are doing.
I'm going to open it up to questions. Please make your way to the microphone so you'll be captured on the recording and introduce yourself as well as giving the question. I mean, I think part of the problem from my perspective on rediscovering ancient writs, which is sort of the strategy here that being characterized as it's not new, it's rediscovering, is these ancient writs, which were broad in many cases, were also developed in a very, very different legal world with separate courts of law and equity, very difficult to bring litigation generally, nothing like notice pleading or discovery or things that were created by law professors under a congressional New Deal Act in the 1930s and these sorts of questions. So they were limited in scope. They were just very much more limited procedurally as well. And I always struggle with, I think it's important to look back to history, and I think original and textual smithing are important tools, but the broad context here has to matter in my view. I also am not sure that, there is a history of a state trying to do something to interfere with another state. Not only that, was when the state of New York tried to give a monopoly on steamships to Livingston and Fulton, and that's what the Supreme Court stepped in Gibbons v. Ogden in 1824.
The statute, right?
So, but the state was stepping in.
But there was a statute. Had there not been a statute, the state monopoly would have been upheld.
Well, right? I mean, it's sort of viewed as a dormant commerce clause.
There was an affirmative act by Congress, and I have no. If Congress tomorrow said, either as part of some other climate legislation or just independently, these suits may not be brought, as a constitutional matter, as a legal matter, that would be the end of the story. Whether that or not that's good climate policy, separate question. No question Congress could do here what it did in Gibbons versus Ogden. But it hasn't.
I guess that's sort of the middle of the let's go to the question. Introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Bonnie Wachtel. I'm in the investment business. Set of words that I haven't heard, although they sort of ring around what you're saying, is the major questions doctrine. And I realize that was administrative law in the federal sector, but still the core of it, I thought, was, look, you're making such a big impact on the economy of the United States. And I'm sure the Supreme Court doesn't want to be relying on that a lot, but still, if that is really, and I apologize, I do not know the details of the Honolulu case, but if that is the concept that you're relying on here, really, could you not fashion that into the question as to whether there's preemption or it falls to the to Congress, that in itself is a major question that shouldn't be decided unless the federal Congress acts.
Well, one issue with the major questions doctrine, and I'd be interested in what others say, is it's about who the conflicting players are. So in the major questions doctrine, it's all about the horizontal axis of Congress versus administrative agencies at the federal level. And what makes this case different in kind is we're talking about federal versus state. So I guess the question I'm urging people to think about is, instead of it being just federal law here beats state law, forget about the federal actor, whether there's been no federal law, period. Do state courts inherently, as a matter of their sovereignty within our system, have the power at this point, common law power, to be imposing potentially this kind of liability? And that, I think, is even more of a threshold question than what Jonathan is saying. Of course, they would have to prove it once we get there, but is this even a valid, legitimate claim that a state court can have under its system of state common law? But that would be a different, so the trouble is the major question. I mean, states, if the states do have the authority, then there isn't really a major question issue, because then they would be the entities who can decide that question, not the federal Congress.
Yeah, I don't think it doesn't have a direct application here, but I think if the idea of it is about, you know, if Congress is going to do something major, they need to say it, then that, I think, supports Jonathan's argument, which is that if they haven't said it's expressly preempted and the states generally have this residual authority, then they need to say it with a level of clarity that would actually prove preemption. So I think that concept could come into play here in supporting the need for express preemption.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree with that, and I'm on record before West Virginia versus EPA saying that preemption, if you look at the way preemption has been handled by the court, as well as the way questions of whether federal law displaces state law, you see something very parallel to the major questions doctrine, and that is to say we expect Congress to be clear, because it's such a significant thing when you have states that have a background police plenary police power and the federal government does not, and when state courts are understood to be, you know, true common law courts and federal courts are not, we put the onus on Congress to be clear. And you see that in, you know, the line of cases that Sackett relies on, like Cowpasture and Swank and DiBartolo. You see that in the preemption cases, right? So in Gorsuch's Virginia Uranium opinion, courts are, quote, hardly free to extend a federal statute to a sphere Congress was well aware of but chose to leave alone, right? That idea that if Congress is aware of something significant and doesn't affirmatively enter the space, we presume Congress did not, is directly parallel to what the Chief Justice writes in West Virginia. So I think if we want to bring major questions into this area, we end up in the spot where we have a legal system that presumes broad developing legal authority at the state level and isolated, targeted, express interventions at the federal level. And in the absence of that, we don't displace the state authority. And even more so here, right, the only statute that can really be used is the Clean Air Act. And the Clean Air Act has a very explicit express savings clause, arguably broader than the savings clause in the Clean Water Act. So it's not only that Congress didn't affirmatively preempt, Congress actually said quite explicitly it's not preempting pollution control.
So Jonathan is correct that states have general police power, but again, I really urge people to think about what that is. Why do they have police power? Because it is in their borders. West Virginia does not have plenary power to regulate Florida. California does not have plenary power to regulate Texas or England. And so I really just think systemically there has to be a lot more attention paid to where does the state's jurisdiction, as a matter of its sovereignty being part of our system with all the benefits that it gets from the federal union, where does it end? And is what these states are doing here, particularly local Honolulu jurisdiction, consistent with the boundaries of state law? Because why do they have plenary power? Why were we not worried about that in our system? Because it was going to be confined to one jurisdiction in one area of the country with a certain set of localized concerns. And so to the extent that it's now becoming a wedge to create federal or international policy, it is categorically outside of our federal constitutional structure and just is utterly inconsistent with it.
And the following conclusion may require a broader dormant commerce clause understanding than we currently have. But part of this, then, the reply would be the states didn't have the authority to enter into the space in the first place, and therefore they're not really being displaced or preempted.
I urge re-examination of Article 1, Section 10 limits. Myself.
I think
is that okay?
That's right, and I agree with the folks on my left here that major questions, the logic, elephants and mouse holes, you know, cuts in John's favor on this. But I also think that with these preemption questions, it's tricky, and that's what I articulated in my 2009 piece with my then colleague Paul Howard in the wake of Wyeth v. Levine, taking some issue with Justice Thomas's no implied conflict preemption position. I mean, because you had Regal v. Medtronic right before that, Wyeth v. Levine, they came out in different things. Obviously, there were amendments to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act in 1976 that created express preemption. So there was a logic to Justice Thomas's position. And yet, when the original Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act was enacted, we didn't have Justice Traynor on the California Supreme Court. We didn't have the Second Restatement of Torts. I mean, these tort claims were unknown. So Congress is going to have to anticipate these weird tort claims, which is why I think, you know, it's a much more complicated question than just saying that, they could have and didn't. Well, you know, same thing here. You know, when the Clean Air Act was enacted, this wasn't on the table in the minds of anyone who was enacting it. Yes, next question. Identify yourself.
My name is Justin Schwab. Very briefly, for the potential Federalist sequel to West Virginia, there's obviously pending litigation, including a pending stay motion from a very large coalition of states activating these issues already before the D.C. Circuit in the Clean Air Act, Section 111, methane, oil, and gas rule. But that's not what my question is about. This is for the whole panel, particularly for Professor Adler. The logic of what you're seeing is that all the hullabaloo over removal and remand over the last few years is a complete red herring. And that if these cases had all been brought invoking the state law but in federal court in the first instance, they should have proceeded. And that the Second Circuit was incorrect in New York State versus Chevron on April Fool's Day 2021. I'd like you to speak to that, please.
Yeah, I think the Second Circuit case is terribly wrong. It's not only wrong as a legal matter, it says a whole bunch of things that are just legally just flat wrong. So for example, let me give some examples. For example, it talks about cooperative federalism as a structure under which the federal government permits and authorizes state regulation. That's not only historically inaccurate, that is just, it gets the premises upside down, right? All of the federal environmental statutes were understood to be enacted against a broad background of active state regulation, and that were worth relatively isolated and limited federal intervention to deal with problems that rightly or wrongly we thought only the federal government could handle. In defense of the Second Circuit, a lot of national environmental groups like to erase that history too, because they like to pretend as if the federal government has broader federal environmental regulatory authority than it does. But the actual history is, it is understood that states were doing this. Their authority was to be preserved. The federal government doesn't authorize or permit them at all. In fact, that would raise commandeering issues if it were. The federal government is rather, in certain circumstances, entering, and in an even more limited set of circumstances than preempting when it enters, whereas most federal intervention in environmental law is not preempting at all. The Second Circuit also talks about there being this careful balance and a federal and international architecture for controlling greenhouse gas emissions. I mean, that's just goofy, right? The United States is not an actual party to any international agreement that obligates the United States to impose binding limits on greenhouse gases. As much as people would like to claim otherwise, Paris, right, requires us to basically pretend. And the idea that there was some congressional enactment that created some balance for climate policy that should oust state litigation is just silly. Congress has never done that. It has never ratified any treaty that obligates us to do anything meaningful on greenhouse gases, and it certainly has not affirmatively enacted any regulatory statute, Massachusetts versus EPA, notwithstanding. Again, I know that there are litigants in courts that make other claims, but I think they are wrong too. So I think the Second Circuit decision was wrong. Although it does create a split with the Hawaii Supreme Court, which is a reason why the Supreme Court might take this case, right? That there is a split. But I think in my article,
wants to respond
I've been
here.
Savage about the Second Circuit. I think it was a terrible opinion.
even if the Second Circuit opinion, and I agree, could have been reasoned in some better ways, I think the conclusions are largely sound. I think it's also, you know, when you saw the vacated decision in the Northern District of California, very similar kind of results. The plaintiffs shifted their strategy to bringing state law claims in state courts because they feared the losses that they were likely to follow from the Chevron case in the Second Circuit, right? So they knew that they were going to lose for precisely the reasons that, well, maybe not the same reasons, but on some of the same rationale that the Second Circuit came up with. So I would trust the plaintiffs' lawyers themselves to know that they had a lot of losing cases from the federal in the federal courts, trying to bring state law claims in federal courts. The other thing I will add is that part of, you know, what we need to recognize is that when Congress chooses not to join or when Congress chooses not to decide, they still have made a choice. So there is still a national policy, and part of that policy can be that we do not want to join this. We do not want to take on additional obligations. We do not want to commit companies within our jurisdictions to these additional obligations. And so if you decide that those kinds of decisions should reside in the national government to decide whether or not to join or not, we can't say that there is not a policy because they haven't joined. The policy is not to join. And that in and of itself should be respected and gets overridden when the states themselves can come in and say, despite the fact that you're not going to add these legislative requirements, we're going to do it through litigation instead.
Let's get the next question. I know Professor Adler wants to respond there, but we'll get the next question and introduce yourself, please.
Taylor Myers with Boyd & Gray. My question is for Professor Mascott. I'm trying to understand what the theory is that you would be going after these cases with if it's not preemption. So is it that it's a judicial taking by the courts failing to dismiss, or is it a contracts clause violation, or is it a failure to apply pre-existing law? Like, what exactly is the hook? Because it's my understanding that under current jurisprudence, state courts are basically free to apply and make law as they see fit. I think that's like Sunburst Oil back in 1932.
But of course, if that's true, that would be within the state conference. If that's true, it makes them more powerful than the federal government. So I agree with your instinct as a coming from the litigation side of wanting to figure out doctrinally what the hook would be. And on that, I confess to liking to throw bombs and being a theorist. And so I haven't myself gone back and looked at the Commerce Clause or the Contracts Clause jurisprudence and precisely doctrinally how you would get there. I think people should spend time doing it. I don't think this is going to be a Dormant Commerce Clause thing because I'm actually saying something categorically different. The Dormant Commerce Clause theory is essentially the idea is we're going to infer and imagine that Congress would have acted or must have meant to act because it's an area of such importance. And I guess I'm saying here, perhaps there just really isn't a role for the state governments to engage in this kind of action in this system. And I think you'd have to, I mean, as an original matter, it must be the case that there's a contract clause problem, right? I mean, lots of contracts are going to be impaired by a judicial lawsuit here, if not by state legislation, if this goes forward. And then in general, the whole Article 1, Section 10 structure of states not being able to enter treaties, compacts, and engage in activity that's going to interfere with the action of other states and lead to disharmony. And I think I think like it did with the substantive due process litigation that Justice Thomas for years has been urging the court to revisit with privileges and immunities, it would serve people well to spend time thinking about whether it's a categorical matter. We've shifted too much into the soft dormant commerce clause space and not spent enough time thinking about Article 1, Section 10 limitations. And I think as for this particular case, I do think one of the keys for the litigators here could be to look at the history of the state nuisance law that Jonathan is talking about and the laws that are being claimed as the basis for the lawsuit and demonstrating and showing that what's happening here and the way in which the claim is being framed and the relief that's being sought is of a different nature than the kind of law that has a historical background, because I think that kind of case would probably be easier to figure that out in a timely way and could be somewhat compelling for the justices.
I mean, of course, the problem is we don't want the Supreme Court substantively deciding the state
tort. I mean, that was the problem with Wyeth v. Levine. I think Maine was out to lunch.
Was it Maine or Vermont?
Vermont. Vermont was out to lunch, but, you know, the Supreme Court's not going to reverse Vermont Supreme Court on Vermont law. I wanted to give John time to respond because I know he wanted to.
I think there are all sorts of things that states can do that affect things that are both national and international, and in no other context do we say Congress's failure to act precludes states using their traditional powers. So let me give you a very simple example. Ducks. Right? Ducks are migratory birds. They cross international boundaries. We, in fact, are in treaties that affect our obligations to both limit the shooting of ducks because they have to be able to fly to Canada and back, right? So Missouri versus Holland, if people remember that case, is all about that. Prior to the United States entering into the Migratory Bird Treaty and then Congress enacting the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, South Dakota, if it was a state then, I may get my history wrong, was not precluded from either regulating or authorizing or limiting the shooting of ducks, even though it would have international implications. Right, the dormant state of that, in the absence of federal action, was South Dakota could do that. Now, South Dakota couldn't enter a treaty with the Crown on its own either, but rather the way we've understood our constitutional structure is that if the federal government realizes, oh, wait a second, this is a transboundary resource that's important to us, and because of international comity and other things, we want to actually manage this resource across the boundary, we, the federal government, will step in and take care of that and or preclude states from doing things that get in the way. And Congress can do that. And we often like it when Congress does. But in every other context where that sort of dynamic arises, we don't say, well, Congress's failure reflects that it likes the status quo. And in fact, in a wide range of contexts, including statutory interpretation, we affirmatively reject the idea that a legislative failure to act is, in fact, an action. It is, given the veto gates and other things that limit the federal government's ability to act, it is nothing more than a failure to act.
Quick question on that. Could South Dakota, in your hypothetical, or in your history, regulate the shooting of ducks in Canada?
South Dakota could try to hold liable individuals that did things elsewhere that imposed costs on South Dakota, and the limitation post-Milwaukee 2 and International Paper versus Ouellette would be insofar as South Dakota law is different from the law of the jurisdiction where the action occurred, South Dakota could not impose kind of home state rules, but could use its own state courts to pursue that claim.
We have fewer ducks in South Dakota because they're being shot in Canada. We like ducks in South Dakota, so we can now prohibit, or we can now allow tort suits against people who kill ducks in Canada in South Dakota.
That probably not, but certainly we know, International Paper versus Let is that case. There is a facility in another state that is doing things that is causing harms in my state, or at least I'm alleging is causing harms that I will have to show in court. Can I sue under state law the facility in the other state? Supreme Court, post-Milwaukee 2, has said yes. The only thing you can't do is have home cooking that somehow gives you an unfair advantage. Right? That is to say, because the concern would be that the plaintiff state would modify its law, like they did with tobacco and a lot of other contexts, to make it too easy to win. And that's a meaningful limitation, right? But and so what the downwind state has to show is that were those harms occurring in the upwind state, which they often aren't because people know where to locate facilities in relation to borders, and there's plenty of empirical research on that, that claim would be viable in the upwind jurisdiction too. And that's the only limitation. And so, you know, the fact that it goes through the atmosphere more and we have, you know, more attenuated effects doesn't change that dynamic. It just means the plaintiff has more to prove or has a higher burden in a properly conducted trial.
Are there limitations on the relief?
Yeah,
or the remedy,
insofar as they
judgments?
Seek damages, insofar as they seek damages, their damages would be limited to activities that are either, you know, caused by those that are properly within the jurisdiction of the court or cognizable to the court and that are visited upon folks within the state's jurisdiction. So in a case like this, again, I think Honolulu has to be able to say, these are the harms that we face in Honolulu. And can they quantify that, you know, the volume of water that goes through, you know, some water treatment plant is altered or changed because of climate change effect on sea level rise? I have no idea if they could show that. And I have no idea if the ultimate amount of money they could claim for that would even be enough to make the litigation worth it. But that, trying to make that claim is not preempted.
I just want, as a wing shooter, to assert a privilege and suggest that we switch to like Minnesota or something, because I go to South Dakota every year bird hunting, but we hunt pheasants. I don't know anyone who goes there to hunt ducks. But let's go to one more question, and then we'll wrap.
Pheasants are better eating.
Thank you. Christina Moore, a former congressional staffer. I did have the opportunity and privilege to investigate a lot of these matters back in 2007-08 and whatnot. So one comment there, which is, you know, EPCA does preempt the regulation of fuel economy, which essentially greenhouse gases are fuel economy. I think the issue there is a lack of standing or an entity having standing in order to challenge the fuel economy standards, right, because of the deal that went down in 2008. Just a comment. My question is, from a congressional perspective, what I'm hearing is there's a call to action. There's a call for Congress to step in and to do something. And again, former congressional staffer hat, is that judiciary that needs to step in and say public nuisance suits in this case are beyond the jurisdiction of states? Or is it energy and commerce that needs to step in with a greenhouse gas legislation preempting state action? Just curious.
If it were up to me, and that's not, but if it were up to me, I would say Congress should take away all EPA authority over stationary source emissions of greenhouse gases, should preclude the bulk of these suits, and impose a revenue-neutral carbon tax that's rebated the way, for example, oil revenues in Alaska are. If it were up to me, that would be the deal I would propose. you know, that and $3 will get you an overpriced coffee drink. But I would think it would be energy and commerce would want to do it. And I would note the history of environmental law includes a lot of statutes that were enacted to replace litigation controls with administrative controls, in part because the regulated community wanted greater predictability and certainty that comes through an administrative process as opposed to waiting to get litigated, right? So a lot of the early, even at the state level, a lot of the early statutes that adopted what's kind of like a water quality zoning model for water pollution were adopted in part as a exchange for providing some relief from the threat of litigation. There's a long precedent for that. Whether my idea of what to do there is the right one or someone else's, I don't know. But I think that something like that would make a lot of sense.
I agree with that. I do think that a larger role for Congress is also to try to investigate how to retain or regain their own prerogatives and protect their own turf. And so to a certain extent, I think the judiciary would be well served to think about greater issues as to how Congress asserts its authority and allows its authority to be respected in spaces where it might be interfered with by state judges or by administrative agencies.
I mean, I think... the reality here is, of course, it's hard to get things enacted, and it's hard to get things enacted by design. And bicameralism and presentment is supposed to make it hard. And that's why we haven't seen action, because there's not a broad societal consensus, which is what it requires to get something through bicameralism and presentment. And that's why I've been so concerned for some time about this sort of adventurous tort litigation from municipalities trying to end run bicameralism and presentment, and use this sort of creative litigation, whether you're rediscovering ancient writs or inventing new ones, maybe a question of interpretation. But there's no question that we're trying to legislate something which is not only national but international through tort law vehicles, using causes of action that were never, as they evolved, designed to hit something this big. Yes, you can worry about your local bird population in the absence of federal legislation. I think this is something much, much bigger. I think most people who look at it will think it's something much, much bigger. I think it looks like there's a split. So, I'm not sure the court's going to come down the way I would want if they take the case, but I think it's an important case, so I think there's a decent chance they will. I appreciate all of you for coming. I think we had really good exchanges from some top flight people up here on the panel. Great questions from the audience. Thanks again to the Boyd and Gray Center, and thanks again to the Federalist Society and everyone else who had a part in making this happen. So at this, I'm going to adjourn. Feel free to talk to us and to each other and mingle as you wish. Thanks.
This has been an episode of Gray Matters. If you enjoyed this discussion, check out all of our episodes on our website at administrativestate.gmu.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @AdLawCenter.